not super crazy about specific targets. For kids, this isn't about giving kids a participation trophy. Believe me, that's not why I'm against targets. I just think nutrition, we really want to be keeping the focus on making it flexible and fun. We want this to be a lifelong habit. So we don't want to put in a ton of rules and not have them develop good habits. We don't want them thinking about perfection at this stage. We want them setting habits at this stage.
Hello and welcome to the Consistency Project podcast. My name is Patrick Cummings. And as always, I am here with EC Sinkowski. Every week on the show, we aim to simplify the science of nutrition, health, and fitness, cutting through the noise to focus on the principles and practices that will help you perform better, feel better, and live better. Thank you so much for tuning into the show this week. Hello, how are you, EC?
Wonderful. How are you doing?
I'm great. We're kind of returning to something that we've done in the past, a little bit different. So this week, we've got a grab bag of listener questions.
We like to mix it up, huh?
We do like to... Our diet, very consistent. Our podcast formats, all over the place.
A little less consistent.
We've got a grab bag of listener questions covering a variety of nutrition and health topics, from the effective diet on cancer risk to the optimal amount of protein for muscle gain. We're also going to talk about hydration, healthy eating for kids, and whether it's okay to indulge in a soda or two every week.
Smorgasbord.
Gasp. Soda or two every week.
Yeah, don't do it.
Before we get into, we got 10 questions. I don't know if I said that. We've got 10 questions. Before we get into them, quick reminder about the 800 gram challenge ebook. You've heard us talk about the 800 gram challenge all of the time. We'll probably talk about it two or three times today. Simple version, eat 800 grams by weight of the fruit and veg of your choice every single day, and then never stop doing that. And then that's the challenge, is to never stop doing it. And that, of course, is a great start. But if you want to understand EC's prescription even more deeply, my suggestion is you start with the 800 gram challenge ebook. It's where EC has collected all the best advice to follow, practical tips for getting started and eating out, as well as some of the pitfalls to look out for. You can get it at optimizemenutrition.com/800G challenge. The link is also in the show notes. It is a great place to start if you happen to be relatively new to EC and to this show. All right. Not quite quick bites, but rapid fire quick bites.
We're going to try.
Really quick bites. That's what we should call this. Really quick bites. This
microwave
is,
quick bites.
I'm heading out the door. I've got 2 minutes to chew something. That's what we got here.
That's okay. It.
So I'm just going to dive right into it. 10 questions. This is the first one from Nick. Do you know of any studies that might show why a diet that is more plant-based, not full vegetarian or vegan, just little red meat, produces better health benefits over a diet that maybe doesn't bias plants as much?
Yeah. There's a pretty cool study by Maximova in the show notes. One of the reasons that people say meat is less healthy is because of this increased colon cancer risk from meat, red meat specifically, as well as processed meat. And we talked about that in detail in an older podcast, which I'll put in the show notes. But this study in particular was an association study, and they looked at cancer risk in 15 different types of cancer. And depending on the dose of meat in the diet, as well as the dose of plant foods in the diet. So a lot going on here. Basically, does a high amount of plant foods in the diet change the cancer risk for people eating meat, which is essentially Nick's question. And so they looked at this population in Canada, about 26,000 total people, pretty big, men and women. And basically, the cancer risk of red meat consumption was nullified the more fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and fiber in the diet. So increasing meat consumption didn't do anything, increasing red meat consumption, I should say, didn't do anything to cancer risk when the fruit and vegetable intake, for example, was high enough. Now, high enough in the study was more than what they say are 6 servings of fruits and vegetables per day. That's where the lowest risk was with this high meat consumption. And that 6 servings or above 6 servings of fruits and vegetables ends up being about 500 grams of fruits and veggies. So my 800 gram challenge practitioners are already there. Now, the fruits and veggies lowered the risk more so than the whole grains or fiber. That doesn't mean ignore whole grains and fiber in your diet. It just means the way that they looked at the data, that the fruits and veggies you could think of are more powerful. Now, they also did look at processed meat. Remember, we typically can separate out the effects of red meat and then processed meat. For processed meat consumption, increasing fruits and vegetable consumption did decrease the risk of continuing to eat more and more processed meat, but it didn't nullify the risk. Meaning, even though people might have had lots of fruits and veggies in their diet, they did lower their risk, but they didn't take it down to if they had no processed meat in the diet, or keeping a very low amount of processed meat in the diet, which is about 42 grams a week or about 1.5 ounces. So we're talking about not that much processed meat in the diet still has the lowest risk, even if you do have lots of fruits and veggies, grains, or fiber. So that is the study, which does show that some diet quality can affect your risk overall. And definitely check out that older podcast, because I think that helps people understand the levels of risk and how to make decisions about food choices and all of those other details.
All right. That was a good job. That was a good, super quick bite.
Good.
Next one we've got, this is from Anne. She says, or she asks, I have a client struggling to build mass. He tries to consume 6,000 calories a day. Good for you. Mm-hmm. He weighs just shy of 100 kilograms or about 220 pounds. Can he consume too much protein? Are there dangers? I've suggested 250 grams a day for now, but I know some days he hits over 350 grams.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, a lot of times questions that people have is basically what's the long-term effect of X? But then long-term studies are hard to do, as we mentioned. Mm-hmm. And then think about something like this, which is sort of an outlier scenario. How are you going to recruit enough people in this case to consistently eat 50 grams of protein a day?
Like, maybe if you studied lions.
Right. Like, really, it's going to be really hard to find some evidence on this for him. So the highest amount of intake that I've seen in protein in studies is 4.4 grams per kilogram, which would actually be around 440 grams per day in this case. Mm-hmm. The problem with that study in terms of helping Ann out here is that it's only eight weeks long, and they didn't actually look at kidney function or blood work, because that's kind of our main concern here. So maybe not that helpful. I have also seen a study with 3.4 grams per kilogram per day. That did not have effects on kidney function. They actually measured it and the people were fine. But the problem with that study is it's only 8 weeks long. So kind of near that 350 number that Anne says her client is at, but we only have 8 weeks of data. So do I want to recommend that for my client long-term? Probably not. So if we find data where they have kind of some long-term numbers, this is the Antonio paper in the show notes. They had 14 guys. And they alternated between their normal diet, which was 2.5 grams per kilogram per day, and then they went up to 3.3 grams per kilogram per day. They alternated in these 2 to 4 month blocks because they continued the study for a year. And basically what they found is that there was no harmful effect on the biomarkers, including kidney and liver function. So I would say comfortably that 2.5 grams per kilogram is safe. Because that was kind of the lower end and they didn't do the 3.3 for the entire year. So I would say that's safe, but again, we're at the limits of, okay, it's kind of a small study and technically it was only a year. I can't tell you what happens in 20 years. So I would be okay at that kind of level, you know, based on the data that we have. Now, you kind of hinted at it when you were reading the question, the 6,000 calories a day. And I know this wasn't part of Anne's question, but I just have to kind of throw this out there as well, even though it might be a slightly longer than quick bite. I do think coaches can be a nice reality check for clients. You know, I don't want to be a dream killer, but 6,000 calories a day is, and still struggling to build mass is, sounds pretty miserable in my opinion. Mm. And so I think sometimes a coach can also just present the realities of someone's genetics. You know, at 6 feet tall, I'm never going to be an Olympic gymnast. I gave that up a long time ago. So I know that wasn't the question, but if you have someone who's truly, truly a hard gainer, they've been trying to do this, they're seeing no progress, it's truly been a long haul that they've done this already, that's a good time to be like, this just might not be what you are meant to do. And maybe we want to refocus the goals a little bit.
Mm. You don't want to be a gymnast anymore?
Shocking. I gave that one up a long time ago.
All right. Question three from Renee. Several of our gym members still follow the habit of 800 grams of fruit and veg from your challenge that we've done. Yay. However, one mentioned that she thought she should still supplement with a multivitamin or more due to how much our modern food supply doesn't have the nutrients it once had. Mm-hmm. Is this necessary?
Yeah, we actually talked about this a bit in the magnesium podcast. I'll link in the show notes. But magnesium is typically the nutrient people bring up, especially when they're talking about, okay, our modern food supply doesn't have as much. Now, I will say there is some evidence that our crops have fewer micronutrients than they once had, as Renee points out. This is in part because we've selected for certain varieties for their yield, meaning we've sort of biased the fact that we really like big apples and we really like big oranges. And so the larger the plant gets, the concentration of their micronutrients has decreased. Now, with that knowledge, of course, people can start breeding plants with more magnesium in it. But anyway, that's where we are right now. So there is some evidence that the quality per unit weight has declined. But the question we have to ask ourselves is, does that matter? Can I still get enough of the nutrients in the foods that exist? And I did do a social media post on this specifically for magnesium and showed that, hey, just a normal diet, I was able to hit the recommended dietary allowance of magnesium, eating a mostly whole food diet, as we know. Now, some of the concerns when I posted that were people pushed back a little bit and said, hey, nice idea, EC, but you don't know that the sweet potato you ate has exactly the magnesium that the USDA measured in their sample size. And I would say that that is true, but I'm also willing to say that the USDA data is representative enough and strong enough across all the foods in my diet that it's probably going to shake out pretty close to what my true consumption was. I understand that there's not perfection in the data, but you're also suggesting that we're going to go out and get our analyses done on every single food that we eat, which we know is logistically impossible. And so I think that in terms of order of magnitude, and by the time you look across all of the foods that you're eating, we're actually going to probably get pretty close. Now, you could say, okay, that's wrong, EC. That's a guess and you don't know it. You are correct. But then I would say, where's the data that the supplementation is actually doing anything? Because that's what we went through in the magnesium podcast. Of course, we've talked about that with the multivitamins. And so we just don't see that supplementation is super beneficial. And I really liked what one article called supplementation and multivitamin supplementation. They called it a harmful distraction. And that's how I see it. I think while I love that Renee's members are still doing the 800 gram habit, and that's what they should continue to do, I do think a lot of people see it as, oh, I'll just do the supplement instead. And we just don't see the benefit there.
Got it. Next question. Oh, is this, does Renee still get Renee, two questions
yeah,
in here?
Gets two.
Oh, Renee,
I think Laura gets two
questions.
Two also. So.
All right. So this is Renee's second question. In the Live to 100 documentary, they mentioned the quote unquote three sisters, which I guess are corn, beans, and squash, and how they contain all nine essential amino acids like protein, virtually eliminating the need to eat meat. Certainly good news to the ears of my vegetarian friends, but as far as muscle maintenance, satiety thoughts.
Yeah, so the problem with getting all of your protein from the three sisters is I think you're going to struggle to get enough protein for the muscle mass goals that your fitness clients have. Yes, you might get enough protein for what's necessary to live. I think you'll be quite full because of the filling nature of corn, beans, and squash. But to get a substantial amount of protein is going to be tough for our fitness and body composition goals. Because let's just take an example. Let's say that somebody needs 100 grams of protein a day, which is really quite reasonable, especially for kind of our CrossFitter or functional fitness audience. And if you were to look at, okay, if they eat 100 grams of corn, they're going to get 3.5 grams of protein. If they were to eat 100 grams of beans, they're going to get 9 grams of protein. And for squash, I'm just going to use pumpkin because that's a common one. Mm-hmm. If they were to eat 100 grams of pumpkin, they only get 1 gram of protein. Okay, so they might eat 500 grams of corn and only get 18 grams of protein, 500 grams of beans, only get 45 grams of protein, 500 grams of pumpkin and only get 5 grams of protein. And so with those 1500 grams of foods that qualify for the 800 gram challenge, they're only at 70 grams of protein. So that's like a ton of food and not a lot of protein. And in fact, all of that food, they're getting 1,685 calories. So what ends up happening here is most of the calories are coming from carbohydrates, not from protein. And so I think it's better off for your vegetarian friends just to find some other sources of protein that are more protein dense, if you will, especially if they have fitness or body composition goals. You know, the vegetarians and vegans, they're more likely going to have to use tofu or soy milk or some of these plant protein powders to more effectively reach that 0.7 grams per pound multiplier we talk about all the time. Yes, have that three sisters corn, beans, and squash for their 800 gram challenge, but certainly don't try to use that as their primary protein sources.
Take it. All right. Question five from Rob. Does the product Liquid IV really increase the rate at which the body absorbs water?
Liquid IV, they have this product called Hydration Multiplier. It's basically sugar, electrolytes, some vitamins. And their main marketing line is that it hydrates you faster, I think three times more faster than water alone or something like that. So the half truth in there is when we absorb water, we can absorb water through different mechanisms. And it is true that glucose and electrolytes actually will move water from your small intestine into the body in a different way than if it was just water. Okay, so that's true. There's another mechanism that could be unlocked, if you will, with the hydration multiplier. The question is, does that matter for you? Do you need it, right? Always the question that we always come back to. So we did a bunch of podcasts on hydration and electrolytes, which we'll put in the show notes. But the short refresher here is, in terms of hydration, what you want to think about, this is very the non-scientific explanation, but the way you want to think about it is your body maintains a specific concentration in your blood. Like there's a certain amount of electrolytes in the total volume of blood in your body, and it regulates that concentration quite tightly as well as the total blood volume. But you also have to remember that that balance is pretty intricate to maintain, because we're eating things with different liquid volume, we're breathing, we're sweating, we're using the restroom. So this balance is almost constantly in flux, and the body is trying to keep the concentration and the blood volume in ranges that are healthy for us. So we get thirsty at 1-2% dehydration, and most people have enough electrolytes in the diet such that we're able to maintain this balance quite well. Yes, we're not always perfectly 100% hydrated. We might be 1-2% dehydrated, but then we just drink our water, we fill back up, and our diet provides us enough electrolytes to make sure that that concentration stays where it should be. It's really only in cases where people are continuously sweating for more than 90 minutes. And I don't like a hard cutoff, but we have to think about that's the duration and the intensity we're talking about. Continuously sweating for more than 90 minutes when they might need specific strategies above and beyond drink to thirst. So anybody else who's kind of a normal diet and not continuously sweating for 90 minutes, the drinking to thirst will be just fine, and you will have enough blood volume and electrolytes. What happens above that 90 minutes is now their sweat, they've lost enough electrolytes in their sweat that when they drink water back, the blood volume won't go up to the same level it was before. And so this is why they have to drink electrolytes such that there's enough concentration that the blood volume goes back up to what would totally fill up the body. Gosh, I'm not using a lot of science terms here, guys. We're staying real basic here, which is totally fine. But that's what happens essentially, is we have to also replace some of the electrolytes so the blood volume stays high, which of course can affect performance. If you have low blood volume, you're going to have low blood pressure. If you want to run fast or bike fast, you're going to make sure that blood needs to be pumping fast. So that's where it can really start to affect performance. Okay, that's a lot of the science background. But for Rob, I know that he was going on an 8-day, 400-mile unsupported bike ride in New Mexico. And so at first thought, I'm thinking, okay, he's probably going to need some supplementation. The problem here is I have no clue about the terrain. I have no clue about the heat. I have no clue about his capacity or the speed. So I really don't know how much he's going to be sweating, how long it's going to take each day. And you'll look up online things like, okay, you might lose a liter of sweat per hour, and this is how much sodium you should take back. But it's really inaccurate. You actually have to go through some of the tests yourself to figure out, this is my typical sweat rate on this type of bike ride and this type of terrain, and this is what my replenishment strategy should be to really get a good replenishment strategy versus kind of following any of this generic guidelines. So in terms of liquid IV, I don't think it's useful for a lot of people. There are going to be athletes who do need to have some specific electrolyte replenishment strategies, but unfortunately, any sort of generic guideline is not actually going to lead you to your best performance outcome. And go check out those hydration podcasts, because they are going to give you more details on how to do that.
Dig it. All right. Question 6 from Emily. What would the daily gram count be for kids on the 800 gram challenge, specifically ages 7-10?
Yeah. And plug for the ebook. This is one of the questions that has more detail on it in there, as well as a lot of other frequently asked questions quite like this about the 800 gram challenge. But yeah, kids, I'm not super crazy about specific targets. For kids, this isn't about giving kids a participation trophy. Believe me, that's not why I'm against targets. I just think nutrition, we really want to be keeping the focus on making it flexible and fun. We want this to be a lifelong habit. So we don't want to put in a ton of rules and not have them develop good habits and not have, and you know, we don't want them thinking about perfection at this stage. We want them setting habits at this stage. So calorically speaking, most kids can do the 800 gram challenge, but I don't like to just say, okay, kids should do the 800 gram challenge. Instead, I think parents should observe where your kids are and then set a realistic goal from there. Maybe they're around 400 grams. Okay, maybe we might stretch to 600 grams. Maybe they're at 700 grams. Okay, then 800 grams is probably fine enough. I think for young kids, maybe doing things is a little bit better than grams. Okay, we had four things today. We're going to stretch for five. We're going to stretch for six. I think that's a way better approach than necessarily setting a hard and fast number based on ages. It's just not going to be appropriate. You're going to find some small kids eat more than some older kids, right? So we want consistency of lifelong habits around whole foods. I will say, because it's not looking at calories, that using a scale, especially once they have math skills, can actually be quite good to work on math and stuff like that. So I don't worry about that from a kid perspective of the totaling. Sometimes they like it. It's fun. It's a new toy, all of that stuff. Yep. And then finally, if they don't hit the target that you have set, definitely don't take, you know, oh gosh, you really messed up today. And instead it's an education. Hey, why didn't we hit it? And what could we have done differently in the day? So we know for next time how to better hit our grams consistently, our target consistently. Much more of an education approach.
I like that idea. My seven-year-old or almost seven-year-old loves calculators and is getting into math. So it might be actually kind of a fun game. Yeah. So cool idea. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Question seven is from Laura. Can you do a talk about water? Can you do a TED talk about water?
Yes.
No. She says, is it okay to add water flavors like Crystal Light? Does coffee or iced tea count towards our daily water goals?
Yeah. So the commonly cited guidelines for water consumption are 2.7 liters for women per day and 3.7 liters per day per men. Mm-hmm. What gets overlooked when we hear those guidelines are that that includes all of the water from food as well as all of our beverages. So you don't have to think about that as that's the water that I have to drink on top of my coffee, tea, fruit and vegetables, all that stuff. And it turns out we actually get about 20% of our water needs from food. Mm. So to answer Laura's question, yes, water flavors are fine. Crystal Light is fine. Again, we have a sweeteners podcast people can check out if they're worried about that. And even caffeinated beverages like coffee and tea can count towards your water goals. For caffeinated beverages, people have concerns because they are a diuretic, meaning they make you urinate. But so long as your caffeine consumption isn't so high, not higher than that 400 milligrams per day, you don't really have to worry that it's going to be a dehydrating drink. Mm-hmm. So yes, all of that stuff counts. The problem is how much then water you specifically need is going to be quite variable, because I don't know how many different beverages you're drinking. I don't know if you're doing more fruits and veggies, which are more hydrating than, let's say, grains or something like that. I also don't know how much exercise you're doing. I don't know the altitude where you are. And so I really don't like giving out, you know, everybody should drink a gallon of water a day, because it's just not appropriate. And so my hydration guidelines are drink to thirst and then maintain a pale yellow urine. Those two guidelines are going to make sure that you're well hydrated and are going to be much more adaptable to your unique needs instead of, again, just a single number to hit every day.
Got it. Okay. We have another hydration question.
Yeah.
This one's from Jason. He says, I know recovery is important. When I am well hydrated, though, I always have to pee in the middle of the night. Currently, my game plan is lots of water in the day, but around 6 p.m. tend to taper off anything hydrating. But then in the morning, I feel somewhat dehydrated. So I'm struggling with this trade-off. Do I stay well hydrated, but get up once and try to get back to bed quickly? Or do I abstain close to bed, be slightly dehydrated in the morning, and start again? I am a morning exerciser, so I do feel like dehydration could impact me for that. But to be honest, I'm not sure I'm smart enough to notice the difference if it was. I think you're smart enough, Jason.
Exactly. I do too. But I think how Jason can best answer his question is to figure out the metric that's meaningful to him. In this case, I think it's going to be that workout performance, right? He's the morning exerciser and is concerned that dehydration is affecting that. And I think instead what he's using as the metric right now is whether or not he gets up in the middle of the night. And believe me, I love sleep, but you know, getting up in the middle of the night is not going to be the best metric of whether or not your sleep was okay. Sure, if you're up for 4 hours, but you get where I'm saying.
Yep.
Sure, we also can have some loss of water in the middle of the night because of breathing. But the body is not that sensitive that we need to be, again, perfectly hydrated at all times, even for exercise, especially if our exercise, we don't sweat enough and it's not long enough. So, you know, it might be that Jason can just get up naturally in the morning when he has less water in the evening, just quench his thirst a little bit, get the morning workout in, and he might not be any worse off. And that's really for him to kind of figure out, probably with a self-experiment. You know, take at least 2 weeks where he kind of does the not drinking after 6 p.m. thing, really check in on performance, and then do it again with another 2 weeks where he's drinking past 6 p.m. and he's getting up in the middle of the night and looking in performance. I do have to mention the science side of me is going to let you know that's still not a valid study. We have some confounding factors going on. But nevertheless, that's the best that we can do. But I'm really just trying to point Jason towards a metric that's a little bit more meaningful, I guess. That's workout performance, not whether or not I get up in the middle of the night, because that's the outcome we care about.
Got it. All right. Laura's back. She snuck another one in and we're staying in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Well, thank goodness for that. She says, what about gut health / poop talk? What if we aren't regular and eat all the veggies and drink all the water?
Yeah, we did actually a podcast on gut health and all of the science behind that. Interestingly enough, we didn't go into regularity. So I guess we missed it.
Trying to keep this show family friendly.
We just talked about science tests and, you know, optimization. Okay. So it turns out, I feel like we have to kind of set this baseline because I think it's a rather large range that being regular can mean going between 3 times a day and 3 times a week. So just wanted to put that out there. But ways that you can increase frequency are basically what Laura suggests. Yes, drinking more water can help. Eating more fruits and veggies can help. But I would expand that a little bit further. As much as I love my fruits and veggies, it would be to look at the fiber, which I'm going to talk about in a second. And then beyond those two that Laura had said, regular exercise can also help with regularity. So with that fiber thing that I mentioned, yes, I love my fruits and veggies, but if you are eating a lot of fruits and veggies, I would also take a moment and look at your fiber consumed within those fruits and veggies. So that guideline for fiber is about 14 grams per 1,000 calories. And so that ends up being about 28 to 35 grams of fiber that people need per day. And so just take 3 days or so and look at your fiber intake. Yes, you can look at what you're just getting from your fruits and veggies. If that's not enough, you definitely want to take a look at the other foods in your diet, because maybe you're just choosing some fruits and veggies like all watermelon or all pineapple, which I love them, but they just don't have a lot of fiber. And so this is a way that you can switch some of your choices or even start looking at things like nuts and whole grains to up your fiber so that you get to that total across all of the foods in your diet. You can also use a fiber supplement, something like Metamucil, which is psyllium husk. We did talk about in the fiber episode that we don't see the same health benefits with fiber supplements as getting it from Whole Foods, no surprise. Mm-hmm. But of course, in terms of some immediate relief, I understand why some supplementation might be actually useful here. And above and beyond that, if you've kind of done those natural approaches, I would just recommend to go see a doctor. I really don't like getting into specific health conditions on the podcast because I do think there's just a lot of self-diagnosis, which can lead us down some wrong rabbit holes. But there's some very common gastrointestinal disorders like irritable bowel syndrome, which constipation can be a symptom. And it's just easier to go through a doctor and get a true diagnosis instead of trying to Google your symptoms and see if you fit in there. So yeah, try the other stuff. Look at your fiber consumption. Persistent uncomfortable, go see a doctor.
Got it. All right, last question. This is from Matthew. I wanted to know if it is reasonable to have 1 or 2 sodas a week. I follow the 800-gram challenge in my daily life, but I don't count calories or macros. Not sure if I'm all the way there, but I'm definitely more intentional with what I put on my plate after following your podcast. I am training for a marathon in April. I drink a lot of water and beverage from First Form. Water gets boring for me very quickly. My brain says, drink a wild cherry Pepsi. My brain does not say that, but the bottle says 250 or 260 calories per bottle, not to mention the sugar content. Will I completely derail my marathon training and my nutrition if I allow myself to indulge in a 20-ounce bottle of wild cherry Pepsi once or twice a week?
So will he completely derail the marathon training? No, no. Let's assume Matthew needs 2,500 calories a day, which is the average for men. That actually could be a little low just based on the fact that he's doing marathon training, but let's just stick with it for discussion. So added sugars are allowed to be up to 10% of the calories in the diet. And so this 250 to 260 calorie bottle, which is all from added sugar, is right there at the 10% kind of cut line for added sugars in the diet. So you could even have one per day. If, before all the people yell at me for recommending soda, oh God, here they come. If the rest of the foods in the diet give you enough vitamins, minerals, fiber, protein, you hit your total calories, all of that other stuff that we talk about all the time. So if his caloric budget is higher because he's so active, larger, has a lot of muscle mass, then his budget for calories that can come from added sugars are even higher. You know, maybe if he's at 3,500 calories a day, he could have about 350 calories coming from added sugar. I do want to mention that these are just rough guidelines. We're talking about biology. There's not you know, at 11% of added sugar calories in your diet, you don't all of a sudden become sick. You know, I know I said 10%, but there's going to be some wiggle room that some people are going to have maybe 15% of their calories coming from added sugar, but because of their other choices, their overall diet is healthy. And so if we really, really want to give Matthew a definitive answer, we'd have to go through something like we do in my masterclass to look at, okay, what are the calories coming in? How does your macronutrients break down? What about your micros? What about your fiber? Where does the Coke fit in relation to all of that to give him, you know, the final answer? But off the cuff, knowing what I know about general caloric consumption and added sugars, that this could very well fit in your budget, especially once or twice a week as he's suggesting he wants to have it.
Take it. Love it. 10 questions. Thanks everybody out there for sending
yes.
those along. One more reminder. We mentioned it a handful of times. I was right when I said it. We were going to likely mention the 800 gram challenge a number of times. We did. One more reminder. 800 gram challenge ebook is a great place to start, or just a great place to get the kind of information you need to actually implement that in a sustainable way on an everyday basis. OptimizeMeNutrition.com/800G challenge. We'll get you more information and a link for the ebook. EC, thank you. Thank you, everybody out there, for listening. Thank you for your ratings and your reviews. Thank you for your questions. We'll try to do this again in a future episode, so keep them coming. We thank you in advance, and we'll be back next week for a new episode of the Consistency Project Podcast.